So to kind of wrap up the second week, sounds very loud. To wrap up the second week, I want to sort of finish off by kind of essentially saying as much as I want to say about gravity solutions in 4D, but also looking forward to having higher dimensional gravity. So we'll be looking at, in more generality next week, having extra dimensions in gravity. But today, I'm just going to look at it more from a perspective of exact solutions and to show that, sort of how do we build higher dimensional solutions. So we'll be kind of looking at some examples, calculating curvature of higher dimensional metrics, also with sort of, generally there's some sort of structure or some simplification of the metric, but they're also sort of fairly general solutions, as well as kind of wrapping up in four dimensions what we can have in terms of extended solutions. So first I should explain the word brain, which we kind of use quite generically to mean something that is extended. So it started off by imagining in four dimensions, you can have a point-like object, so that's your black hole. You can have an extended object, which is a string, or you can have a planar-type object, which is a wall or a membrane. And so as people began to investigate solutions in higher dimensional supergravity, they wanted to sort of carry on up from the membrane and the analog of higher dimensional brain. So initially, there was a sort of little spat about what these would be called. There's M-brains was one initially, and then P-brains was perhaps one of my favorites. But in the end, the generic word brain just stuck. So string theory is full of D-brains, which are something specific, Dirichlet brains, but you can also get more general solutions in higher dimensional supergravity that are not necessarily specifically associated with given objects in string theory, such as the Dirichlet brain. So this is really just a generic term for an extended solution. So what we usually find is that a zero brain is a point. So the number that we, if you see a number put before brain, it's the spatial dimension of the brain. So that's just to sort of explain terminology. Now, yesterday I didn't really show you in detail how it was done, but I told you about strings or one-brains in four-dimensional gravity. Now, if we're in vacuum Einstein gravity, these can't have horizons, they're not black holes. But nonetheless, they do correspond to legitimate extended solutions in four-dimensional gravity. So I'd like to just sort of complete the story by talking about two brains in four dimensions, which are walls, domain walls. So what I'm going to do is start with codimension one. So in other words, I imagine I've got some surface which I'm going to coordinatize by x mu. I know I'm going to come back to talking about d equals 4 at the end, but for the purposes of computing the curvature, I just want to keep it general for the moment. So I'm going to say we're in D dimensions. So I have codimension one, so I have a single normal, n. And I'm going to choose particular coordinates, which are called Gaussian normal. So what does that mean? It means that I choose Z to be the proper distance from the wall. So I have a set of coordinates on my wall. I've got a normal at every point on the wall. I integrate up from the wall geodesically, and then I simply define this Z coordinate as the proper distance along that integral curve. Now, there may be caustics in the sense of if I had a, you know, if I sort of imagine curving a piece of paper in three-dimensional space, if I integrate up along this normal and along this normal, they're eventually going to cross. So that will show up as a coordinate singularity, but in a neighborhood of my brain, I can set up these coordinates. So this is certainly a legitimate coordinate system. And I'm imagining that the energy momentum, at least for this starting purpose, that my energy momentum is very strongly localized, so that's sort of a something that is either a delta function or approximating a delta function, and that it looks, for the moment, it looks like a cosmological constant in the directions of the brain. So I'm going to look for a solution that is simply a translation of whatever the metric is on the wall, on this brain, and it sort of, it can distort as I move away from the brain, but it's just a simple scale factor times that brain metric. So this is, at this moment, this is an ansatz, an assumption. I'm just going to see where it gets me and what space-time it gives. So, in other words, for now, I'm just going to assume that gamma is just a function of x, and we'll see where we get to. So I'm going to compute the curvature of this metric, and then I'm going to come back and tie it into the energy momentum tensor, and then I'm going to show you how you can actually make one of these walls by giving you an explicit example of some source. So in order to compute the curvature, I want to set up my orthonormal basis, and that's actually quite easy here. Call this A. So in order to set up my orthonormal basis, dz is obviously one of the components, and then I want to make this part of the metric orthonormal, but obviously I've got a factor of A, but what I'm saying now is I take a orthonormal basis of gamma, which is E naught, and that's or omega naught, and that's representable as E naught A mu dx mu. So I'm not making any assumption for now about the form of gamma, other than it only depends on x. So this is a sort of example where this Cartan method is particularly powerful. So obviously d omega z is zero, and then for d omega a, I've got two pieces. The first bit is a cross term between omega a and omega z, and the second bit is now just the exterior derivative of the orthonormal basis of gamma. And so that is given by the background connection forms for the metric gamma. Using Cartan for gamma, I simply get that d omega naught is minus theta naught AB, wedge omega naught B. And then I pull that A in to change the omega naught to an omega. So from this, I read off my connection in terms of the connection of gamma and the function A. And then the curvature is fairly straightforward to compute. I use Cartan's second equation, and I see that I get an R naught. Plus something that depends on that factor A, which we call the warp factor. So that's almost all of my curvature 2 forms. The only ones that are left to calculate are the mixed forms from A and Z. So that's simply d of theta AZ, which is d of a primed omega naught. So that's the first bit is a, gives me an a double prime dz. And then the next bit is a primed d of omega naught. And then I've got my cross term, theta wedge theta. But this theta bz is simply a primed omega naught b So that's, and this d of omega naught is simply minus theta naught wedge omega. So these two terms actually cancel. So that's really the end of the computation of the curvature. So I can read off my Riemann tensor in that orthonormal basis. So for very little work, I've now got quite generic curvature tensor for this codimension one object, which has, at the moment, an arbitrary geometry. So if I now want a coordinate basis, which I usually do, then I'm finished. That's my Riemann tensor. And so now I can find my Ricci tensor and my Einstein equations. So let's just see it in action by looking at an example of an extended source in four dimensions that gives rise to something that we call the domain wall. So this is kind of a nice example because the sort of mathematics involved is fairly straightforward. You know, you can do pretty much almost everything analytically, and it also illustrates some curious things that happen can happen when you have extended objects. So first of all, I just want to persuade you that we can construct one of these things from an actual source. So I'm going to consider an interacting scalar field. Which has a sort of double well potential. So this is a sort of classic example of spontaneous symmetry breaking in its most simple form. So our potential has a Z2 symmetry, but when we want to quantize, we go to the vacuum, which is either the plus minimum or the minus minimum. And as soon as we've gone there, we've broken our Z2 symmetry. So we've got a choice. Our vacuum is non-trivial. So we can ask, what happens if we're in a situation where in some regions of space we've chosen one vacuum, and in other regions of space we've chosen a different vacuum? Now, when you're sitting and playing with Lagrangians, you don't tend to do that because, you know, you're in charge, you can choose the vacuum. But the motivation for thinking about this is that if we imagine an actual realization of these field theories, then our natural context is the very early universe. And at high temperatures, the form of our effective potential changes. So at very high temperatures, we tend to have symmetry restoration. And it's only as our universe cools down that we get to go through a sort of sequence of symmetry-breaking phase transitions. And of course, whenever you have an actual sort of physical state where you're sort of looking where there are definite horizons, such as in our universe, then it's possible for things to select different vacua in different regions. So that's kind of the motivation for why this is not a daft thing to do. And of course, for sure, in condensed matter systems, you get these things arising because there you also have sort of notions where you have effective symmetries in one phase and then, you know, the phase changes. So let's have a look at our phi equation of motion. And I'm going to just first look at this without worrying about gravity. So I'm going to first check this on a flat background. And I'm going to look for a solution such that phi tends to plus eta as z goes to plus infinity and minus eta as z goes to minus infinity. So my equation of motion there is minus phi double prime plus 2 lambda phi squared minus eta squared equals 0. Looking at my wave equation. So this is solved. Actually by a tanh function. So the derivative of tanh is sec squared, and of course 1 minus sec squared is tanh squared. So you can kind of see how, and of course the derivative of sec squared is sec squared tanh. So this is tanh sec squared and this is sec squared tanh, so you can see how that works. So moreover, my energy momentum tensor
Z
naught. So let me sketch what this looks like. So it's just a simple tanh function. It's based at the point z naught, which isn't really, that's a sort of just a parameter. It's not no real physics contained in it at the level of the background solution. And the sort of width of this is of order 1 over root lambda eta, which is, of course, the mass scale of the particle when you quantize around the individual vacuum. So my energy momentum tensor has the following form. And if you input this solution, you see that indeed you have that symmetry that I was wanting before, something proportional to the induced metric on the brain. So I find for this background solution with no gravity that the ZZ component of my energy momentum vanishes and the others are all equal and they're very sharply localized. We've got this such to the fourth function and so we have something that's very sharply localized at a scale determined by the underlying parameters of the theory. So the sigma that I put somewhere, oh, didn't I? Oh, yes, right at the top there, which was meant to represent the energy per unit area, that's finite. So this is not a singular object necessarily. But if we look at it from the perspective of this flat background solution, our area of the wall is infinite. So that's kind of, you know, it's in one sense, it's nicely behaved. It has what we're looking for. It's localized. It's got some finite energy. The energy momentum is proportional to the induced metric. Mm. However, the area of this wall is infinite. Mm. So, typically, if you have an infinite energy in gravity, you sort of feel a bit nervous because you might think that something's going to go wrong. But let's see what happens. So in order to find the gravitational solution, I'm going to assume everything still just depends on this normal coordinate, Z. And so these would be my Einstein equations for the geometry. And then, of course, I've got my field equation, but I now have to take the field equation in the metric that I have, so my phi equation of motion is slightly modified. Now, what I can do at this point, right, I mean, obviously, I can just put the whole thing on a computer and try and integrate it up. But it's always, before doing something like that, it's always useful to try and ask yourself, what information can I glean about the system by just thinking about what it's likely to look like? So what I can do is I can use some of what I've just found in flat space by imagining that this thing is very weakly gravitating. So I can take a weak field limit and say, well, if gravity is weak compared to the particle interactions, which let's face it, it usually is, then I can take this flat solution as an approximation and use it to try and determine what my gravitating solution is. So in my, if I look at the sort of characteristic scale of my energy momentum tensor, and I'm going to ignore the Z naught now because it's just a translation degree of freedom, so it's a gauge degree of freedom. And so if I ask what is 8 pi g v, then I've got the typical scale of v as lambda eta to the fourth, so I'm splitting this up into something that is governing the width of the wall and something that's governing the gravitational attraction. So it's this that's going to be small. And the other factor is just something that's telling me about the wall width. So I'm going to choose that to be one, and all that means is I'm choosing units in which the wall has unit width. So if I now say, okay, let me use my background solution, calculate what happens to the gravity. In the background, V is equal to phi prime squared on 2, and so this GZZ is 0. So if I look at it now from this perspective, this is telling me that my gamma cannot be flat. So gamma has to have some background Ricci curvature. And given that I want to have a symmetry sort of that fits with this cosmological constant form, what it suggests is that gamma is a constant curvature metric. So my g, remember mu is 0, 1, 2 here, g is like 1 over L squared, and I then see that my a primed on a is then plus or minus 1 over L, looking at the gzz equation. I then go in to look at gtt, sorry?
L?
I'm just introducing L as a constant curvature space. I'm going to find out what it is in a minute. So at the moment, I'm just saying, let me have a constant curvature space, curvature radius L, so in other words, something like de Sitter, and the fact that GZZ is zero tells me that A primed is of order 1 on L, and so now I'm using G naught naught to tell me that to relate a double primed to the energy density, but I can integrate this up to get a form for A primed. So if I then say I go outside the wall, I see that my A primed goes between plus and minus 2 epsilon on 3. So that's what I'm getting. Let me just sort of see how, whether that's consistent. So at first sight, you might say, well, hang on, didn't you tell me that A primed on A was constant? A is 1 to leading order. So that's saying A primed is constant. So you might be a bit worried that I've got some actual continuous behavior of A primed. But don't forget that these terms here are order epsilon squared. So whereas the right-hand side is just order, is just 0 to order epsilon. So what I would have to do is I'd have to go in and solve to order epsilon for phi, which would give me an order epsilon squared piece here, which you can see would be, could be responsible for smoothing out that A function. So all I'm doing here is getting a leading order solution that is consistent. So this tells me here that L is equal to 3 over 2 epsilon. So if epsilon is small, L is big, which means that the constant curvature space is, has a large radius of curvature, and so is very gently curved. So I've said that De Sitter space has many coordinatizations. I've chosen the global one here. So to sketch my A, this is my sketch of A of Z, much exaggerated because, of course, it has a very gentle, the gradient, 1 over L is very small. But you see that it's basically a straight line here, a straight line over here, and then just at the scale of the width of the wall, it makes that transition quite sharply between one and the other. So if I were plotting my energy density of the wall, it would be very sharply localized around that region. Now, outside the wall, we have no energy momentum, so obviously our space is Riemann flat, but one of the bizarre things is that it's also Ricci flat. So after yesterday, you're not going to be drawn on saying that this metric is curved, I dare say, and you would be right, because in fact it's flat space. So if I choose a new time and a new, sorry, that should be rho, t, sorry, tau, not zeta. If I choose a new rho and a new time, I get flat space. So this is kind of a bit weird because what we have, z equals 0, which is the location of the wall, corresponds to rho squared minus tau squared is L squared. So this is all sounding very familiar from the Rindler space perspective. And what we have, if I draw rho squared minus tau squared as L squared, I get a hyperboloid. So this is my wall. And if you remember, I claimed that De Sitter space was just a hyperboloid embedded in one dimension higher. So given that the wall intrinsic metric is just De Sitter, this kind of makes sense. But something more interesting is happening here, because if I ask what happens when I, what's happening to this bulk space-time away from z equals zero, as z increases, I actually go inside towards this light cone of the origin here. So this space in here is z greater than zero. Now, what happens for z less than zero? Well, if z is less than zero, because of this modulus here, I would have to instead have 1 plus z on L. And what I actually have is the very same picture. So my space-time is exactly symmetric around z equals zero. So I haven't got Rindler space. Rindler space would just be this whole wedge over here. Instead, I've got this bit sort of living between z equals zero and this, well, the light cone, or I can analytically extend, and I've also got this bit. So I have a hyperboloid, its interior, plus a second copy. And so my wall essentially glues these two surfaces together. So I have two copies of the hyperboloid. So if I ask, for example, what happens at tau equals zero, which is actually the same as t equals zero, so constant time slice, I've got an interior of the hyperboloid here, I've got a sharply curved regime where the wall is, and then I've got another copy. So what I actually have is this would be the wall. I've now got something that's topologically spherical. So I have, it's kind of hard because we're living in four dimensions, but if we drop down a dimension, you've got a hyperboloid. Right in the middle at t equals zero, you've got a disk. And so that's z greater than zero. And then for z less than zero, you've also got another disk. And these two are glued together on their boundaries. So if you imagine now making, instead of a very sharp wall, fuzzing it out a little bit, you kind of see you've got something that looks like a tortilla. You've got a top and a bottom and something very sharp that goes around in the middle, or a burger bun, however you want. Whatever culinary analogy you wish to use is yours. So this is an example whereby originally our wall had infinite energy because it was infinite area. And so you add in gravity and you think, oh dear, infinite energy, I could get into trouble. But in fact, what gravity does is it regularizes itself, and it has spontaneously compactified that wall. And the wall now has finite area because it's simply this sort of circumference here. So it's now got a finite area, and therefore we have no infinite energy at all. So it's just one of these extremely quirky aspects of gravity when you have sort of objects that are extended. So that's sort of given you an example, you know, which where we can basically do the job without having to, you know, resort to a numerical solution. Admittedly, it's sort of doing it perturbatively, order by order in epsilon. But nonetheless, you can see that, you know, this is representing what the full structure is. So you can go ahead, you can put the equations, sort of ask, you know, I mean, these are very simple equations, so you can get Maple or Mathematica to solve them. And you can see that indeed what I've just said is a correct representation for the full solution. So I just want to now say a bit more generally. I can start to construct higher dimensional solutions. So if I just say A is 1, so I look at my Ricci tensor and I can see that I've got no contributions coming from A. And in addition, gamma is an Einstein manifold, so its Einstein tensor vanishes, then this metric will now solve the higher dimensional Einstein equations. So for example, if we have a Schwarzschild solution, and I simply add an extra direction, that's also a solution in five-dimensional Einstein gravity. So what this looks like is a black string. So this would be the theta and phi directions, and this would be my z direction. I've got my black hole, the theta and phi, two sphere, but it's now extending in an extra direction, the z direction. And I can add more. More flat directions to get a black brain. So whereas I claimed that in four-dimensional gravity you had to have spherical horizons, you're now seeing that in higher dimensional gravity that's no longer the case. It's very easy to construct horizons that are cylindrical, planar, whatever. So if I now don't want to just have a four-dimensional solution with flat directions, what more can I do? So again, this is going to be a demonstration of the fact that Cartan can be very useful when you're just dealing with things in the abstract. So what I want to do now, this should sort of look familiar in the sense that this is now a sort of completely spatial n-dimensional. So this, in the case of Schwarzschild, we looked at this, where this was a two-sphere. But now I'm saying it's a completely arbitrary n-dimensional metric, Euclidean metric, with gamma as a function of, sorry, it shouldn't be x, that should be y. gamma is a function of y. This one here is going to be a p-dimensional, probably want p plus 1 actually. And again, it's going to be quite general, where g is a function of x. Now, I'm not going to go through in full detail. I'm going to kind of piggyback on what I just did for the wall. But you can see that what it looks like is the wall here plus another bit, another sort of spatial extra manifold tacked on. So I'm going to do the same sort of Cartan thing. I'm going to have a sort of set of forms here that are like A omega naught, and here again, just, you know, with respect to some arbitrary orthonormal basis of the internal metrics. So when I compute my connection, I'm just taking D of these forms, and you can see there's going to be no mixing between the mu indices and the alpha indices at the level of the connection, because D omega mu is only going to have either an omega mu in it or a dr. So you can piggyback on what we just did. And just simply state what the connection for one forms are. So I mean, it's exactly the same as what we did for the wall, but you do it first for the first bit, the G part, which we already did, and then you do it for the gamma part, which is exactly the same. So we've already got the curvature 2 forms written down for the mu hat indices, so I'm not going to write them again. And these are what you can read off by using the analogous method. And then the only new thing that we pick up is this level, you do get a cross term for mu and alpha. So by simply drawing, having done the work already for the codimension one object, I've now got the basis of the calculation, and I can just read off these results. So it's really not a lot of effort to calculate the curvature of that sort of metric ansatz. And that covers a sort of very wide range of different solutions or possible solutions. So what that means is my Riemann So these ones were just reading off what we had before for, and you know, just for both sets of metrics. And then the final piece that I get, which is the cross term, so I think this particular example of computing the curvature of that metric is one which actually illustrates well just how powerful that Cartan method can be. Because in the sort of, you know, matter of two boards, we've got the curvature tensor of a fairly general metric with, you know, and even though I'm allowing G and gamma to be arbitrary, I never need to know what they are in order to find this result. I'll just write down Ricci because I want to use it as to illustrate an example. And so this is kind of a building block for solving higher dimensional brain solutions, a sort of So let me just illustrate it with a very simple example, which is higher dimensional Schwarzschild. So here my P would be zero because I want a black hole. And in the gauge I've chosen, it's a little different to what we did because I've chosen a gauge now in which R is the proper distance, but I still have a D minus two sphere. And so if I can read off, I just look at what my Riemann is by setting P as zero, so I don't have that piece there. And then I'm going to let C equal rho, which is more conventional, and dr is d rho on A, so that I end up with something that looks more like Schwarzschild. And then I see that dc by dr is A, and d squared c by dr squared is a primed. So, I mean, these over here, this is d squared by dr squared, and this is a primed of rho, now d by d rho. And so if I put in this assumption, I find that G00 is D minus D minus 2 And so as before, as we found in our four-dimensional case, the TT component of the Einstein equations is particularly straightforward. We can sort of write it as a total derivative. And so we find so here, AD minus 2 is the area of a D minus 2 sphere, and our M of rho is the integral of the energy density appropriately normalized. So it generalizes Schwarzschild to higher dimensions. It identifies what the mass function is. And of course, you can go ahead and construct rotating solutions and a whole plethora of higher dimensional black hole solutions. So I think I should probably stop there. But I'm just going to refer you to, these are called Myers-Perry, so Rob Myers, who's here at Perimeter. And these were worked out back in, I want to say 80s, but it might have been late 70s. I'm just blanking on the exact date. But right back in the early years when people were beginning to realize that, you know, string theory was potentially telling, no, it's got to be 80s then, that you have more than four dimensions, these guys were sort of the first people to start thinking, well, what happens, you know, with gravitational solutions if you're in higher dimensions? So this one is the simplest, it's uncharged, not rotating, but it's showing you what the equivalent Newtonian potential is in higher dimensions, 1 over r to the d minus 3, and it's also giving you the relation, the sort of identifying what the mass is in terms of that fall-off parameter.